Hey, I'm Jeff Cohen. Everything you hear on WNPR, from local news and talk shows to the national programs you love, is made possible because of listener support. You make it happen. You give the radio its signal, the computer its stream, the smartphone its podcast. You make it so we can reach you wherever you are. We love that you listen, but we also need your dollars. Go to WNPR.org and click on Donate in the upper right-hand corner. Thanks for helping out.
From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
President Obama, in his first public appearance since leaving office.
What's been going on while I've been gone?
He's been a tremendous champion of supporting families and enabling them to thrive in the new reality of
the reaction from the audience.
President Trump's former national security advisor under fire as questions swirl about whether he broke the law over payments he received from Russia and Turkey.
As President Trump closes in on 100 days in office, his administration is setting up a showdown over funding for a border wall.
The president's priorities have been very clear from the beginning.
Congress has until Friday to approve a spending bill and avoid a government shutdown.
Those are just a few of the stories of the week. And you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're going to start with what's been happening at the state capitol. Lots of chaos and drama yesterday. And we want to start with our own Colin McEnroe, of course, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Daniela Altamari is here. She's State House reporter for The Hartford Current. Hello once again, Daniela.
Hi.
And Max Reese. He's a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Hello, Max.
Good morning, John.
Okay, so first of all, I want to say the Connecticut Mirror's Keith Thaniff will be on Where We Live tomorrow morning, talking more about the state budget, so you can listen for that. Reading from the Hartford Current, amid partisan squabbling and finger-pointing, a plan to vote on a $20 billion state budget blew up Tuesday, with legislators blaming each other and failing to make progress. That sort of all seems about right, but there's some differences here. Let's actually listen to a little bit of audio. This is taken from the Hartford Current's website. These are dueling press conferences after this blow-up, and we're going to hear from Joe Arisimowitz and Themis Claridis. Let's go.
For 2 months, we've worked on a compromise bill that my caucus have put things into and taking out of a budget that they didn't necessarily agree with. But they did it in an effort to come up with an agreement that would have a bipartisan tone, that would be a compromise agreement.
They very well knew we were working on our own.
We did that for 2 months. We prepare a product over the weekend that contains those attributes. And at the last moment, they say, well, we're not voting for it. It's now a Democratic budget.
I think we made it clear early on that, and they want to differentiate between appropriations and finance, and that's fine, but the reality is we're not voting for a $500 million tax increase. The end. They can call it anything they want. They can say it's bipartisan. That doesn't make it so. My ranking member of appropriations wasn't even involved in the negotiations, and they wanted to use the chair, the House, the Senate, Republican chairman as a scapegoat.
Okay.
Mom and Dad are fighting.
So there are Democratic and Republican leaders trying to explain why this so-called bipartisan attempt at a state budget didn't work yesterday. I'll start with you, Daniela and Max, because you guys spend all your time down there. And maybe you can explain to me and Colin and the rest of our listeners what exactly the heck happened. They're pointing at each other. This is great. OK, Max, go first. Go.
Sure. So yesterday was a mess. So listeners, yesterday was as close to like a nuclear collapse or fallout in the Connecticut State Capitol. And I resent that. I do a lot of other things than hang out in the State Capitol building, John.
You didn't really phrase that the best way.
Yeah, but I do many other things, though, recently, no. But what essentially happened was late Monday, it was made pretty clear that we were going to have something that looked like a budget. What would be in it precisely, we weren't sure on. We did know that they were going to strip out some of the more controversial things that the governor wanted in there, sending $400 million in pension responsibility to cities and towns, for instance. What we weren't positive on was whether they were going to include new revenue in there. Then by about 3 o'clock on Tuesday, rumblings had made their way through the building that Democrats didn't have the votes, that they didn't have the votes to pass out. Well, we say Democrats because they're the ones who control the House and they have the one vote tiebreaker in the Senate. And then all hell kind of broke loose with everyone pointing a finger at each other saying this was the Republicans' fault because they wouldn't agree to agree, but it's a Democrats' fault because they couldn't wrangle the votes. No, but it's really the Republicans' fault because they just want to vote. They just want to vote no on anything, no matter what. No, it's a Democrats' fault because they wanted to raise taxes, even though the budget actually correct me if I'm wrong, Danielle, it actually didn't even have any tax increases in it, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's so complicated, and there's so many dueling storylines. You know, you hear the Democrats talk, and they say, you know, we went out on a limb. We put this budget together, good faith, bipartisan effort. And you guys, you know, are walking away, washing your hands off of it. We don't want to be stuck with this thing. I mean, it's bad. It's, you know, there's a lot of difficult things in there. And then you hear the Republicans and they say, you know, no, you guys are just using us as an excuse. You don't have the votes. You still do have a majority on the committees and in the legislature. So, you know, you guys can't get your own messy caucus together. And now you're pointing fingers at us.
Well, and I think there's two big questions sort of coming out of this. One is that this question that Danielle just raised, Max, which is the Democrats don't have the votes. I tuned in to the Joe Arasimowitz press conference just at the point in which he was yelling at the Waterbury Republican Americans, Paul Hughes, about that question of, you know, why are you blaming the Republicans if you don't have the votes in your own caucus? It's like, well, it's not that simple, but isn't it? Just to be fair, kind of that simple?
It basically, yes. Politics 101, yes. If you're they have a 7-vote majority in the House, or well, really a 3-vote majority in the House, and they should be able to do that. And what I think this boils down to is a couple of key points. Number one, is the Democratic House caucus as out of control as they were a year ago and 2 years ago, where they couldn't even put together a budget? Is that still the case? But secondly, are the Republic? It's hard to figure out who's being honest here on either side, because the Democratic issues are—
I have a guess.
There you go. The Democratic issues are kind of well-versed. But on the Republican side, they've made it pretty clear they don't want to vote for anything. They don't want their fingerprints on any budget. So are the Democrats having a competence issue, and are the Republicans having an abdication of responsibility issue?
Colin?
I think that's a pretty good way to frame it. First of all, they should all, and both sides, should be ashamed of themselves. I mean, this is a really big problem in all the ways that Daniela and Max are suggesting. It's a big and possibly somewhat intractable problem that needs the absolute best efforts and the most sincere efforts of everybody. And we are getting the exact opposite, particularly from these two people. And, you know, I know Governor Malloy is in Puerto Rico right now, and I don't think he would be the guy to do this, and now I'm going to sound really old, but, you know, Ella Grasso would have dragged these two people in to our office and ripped them up and down until the skin was hanging off their body and say, you guys are an embarrassment. Get out there and get this budget passed and stop having press conferences about how much you hate each other. And I would say, that since she's not around right now and neither is Malloy, I'll say that to them too. Shut up. Shut up and go do your work. And the Republicans really do need to get to the table on this. You know, one thing that Arasimowitz is right about is that Republicans, specifically, Themis and Len Fasano, have been whining for many sessions now about how they're not included in things and they need to be at the table. Okay, you're at the table now. What have you got? And they've got, as far as I can tell, they've got nothing. They've just not really put together or put out any particular proposals whatsoever. Malloy is on relatively solid ground, saying he's the only person who's really stuck a balanced budget out there that, you know, people can look at and understand. It may not be everybody's favorite balanced budget, but it was a balanced budget. And, you know, I don't know. This is very depressing to watch this unfold.
The Republicans did say it's coming. Just be patient. They're working on it.
Yeah. It's like late April. It's almost May. What have you been doing for months?
And Donald Trump's working on a tax plan this week, too, and it's going to be fabulous. But anyway.
Well, I'm just saying that's what they've been saying, that they are working on a plan, and it won't have tax increases in there. We'll see. I mean, you know, there's a certain amount of magic to all these budgets, and, you know, who knows?
And with Republicans, it was really interesting. You know, you're going to have Keith Faniff on tomorrow. No one knows the state budget the way Keith Faniff does. On two different occasions yesterday in two different press conferences, that's how many times we talked to these people yesterday. I talked to them more than my wife yesterday. And
I said that's all you do. But anyway.
I guess the truth is coming out as we're in this show, John. But when Senator Fasano said for the second time that they were going to have a Republican budget, even Keith goes, wait a minute, really? This is the first we're hearing of this. And then Len said, yeah, we gave it to the Office of Fiscal Analysis. They're going to provide an analysis of it. They're going to give us a breakdown. That was a surprise to everybody. I don't know whether the Republicans were hiding the ball on that or whether they thought they were clear on it, but I don't think anybody had a clue at this point in the session that they were going to put out what would look like their plan.
So the one thing that we have agreed on, we've actually agreed on a couple of things that are off the table. These major tax hikes, Daniela, that we were talking about over the course of the last couple of days. Last week on the program, we talked about the possibility of income tax hikes or really massive tax increases on millionaires, something that state employee unions really want. These are things that aren't going to make it into any budget.
It looks like they're not. They did the Finance Committee, which is the, you know, the other arm of the budget, the revenue arm, as opposed to the Appropriations Committee being the spending arm. They did hold a hearing yesterday, lengthy hearing, on these tax increase proposals. And this idea of raising the income tax on the top earners does, you know, not seem to have momentum. Republicans were critical, saying, why are you even having a public hearing on this? This is a bad thing. You know, it's going to hurt businesses just by talking about it. And the Democrats were like, well, you know, you guys blast us for not holding hearings on things. So we figured we'd do it. I do wonder also if it's a way to sort of smooth out some of the ideological differences in the Democratic caucus. There are some folks, you know, on the Finance Committee, the Bernie Sanders wing of the party that want to see taxes raised on the rich. And so by at least giving it a public hearing, maybe that buys the Democrats a little bit of unity that they wouldn't have otherwise.
You got a $1.7 billion, roughly, I'm not Keith Faneuf, but something like that, a $1.7 billion problem. And, I mean, most of the tax stuff that we've heard talked about kind of nibbles at that as opposed to really solving it. So, I mean, for example, one I doubt this will get out of committee, but one thing Finance, Revenue, and Bonding was looking at yesterday was the notion of making nonprofits like the one that we're sitting in right now pay sales tax. I don't know. I mean, I know why nonprofits don't like that idea, but I don't think it's a completely crazy idea. But there's a lot of pain associated with that and a lot of screaming and kicking associated with that. And then at the end of it, what do you get, like $200 million? Well, which is not nothing, but it's not – it doesn't – it's, you know, it's a $1.7 billion problem. It's hard to fix a $1.7 billion problem.
Where I think the Republicans definitely have their messaging, I think, right on point is you had two income tax increases in the last, what, 7 years, right? Mm-hmm. Two income tax increases in the last 7 years, not to mention the income tax being issued in 1992. How do you look taxpayers in the eye and say, we need a lot more money, not a lot more money, kind of a crazy amount of money, what amounts to almost 10% of the budget after all these tax increases? Like, what is so wrong with government that we need this much more money? And the Republicans are saying, no, we think we can do it without any of that money. And apparently the Democrats said that with a budget yesterday as well. But who knows whether that budget's ever going to come to fruition.
I think Colin raises a good point about all these little, you know, taxes here and there. You know, you raise $200 million here, you know, a couple hundred million there. Sometimes they're more trouble than they're worth. I mean, we had the famous car wash tax mess of a few years ago, and they ended up having to repeal it. And, the optics just look bad. You know, you're going to go after nonprofits for, you know, the paper and the printer ink that they buy. I mean, it just, you know, for the amount of money it raises, it's more, it looks really bad. It's more of a headache than it's
especially
worth.
Especially while at the same time the state is trying to offload an awful lot of work that is done by the state onto nonprofits.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
To make those nonprofits less viable seems like not necessarily the best option.
The nonprofit community always says, we love this plan. It's going to work. We can do this work. But if you don't fund us, then we can't do it. Mm-hmm. And it would still be cheaper than the state doing it.
I will ask just before our break, though, a couple other things that maybe of all the issues that are not being agreed upon, we've said, well, here are some things that probably won't end up in there, these big tax increases. What are some other things that Governor Malloy was trying to do, Max, that probably aren't going to be in this budget, no matter who it comes from?
The biggest thing was, without a doubt, the $400 million in the pension shift to cities and towns, where essentially the way the system works now is the state handles the employer side, the entire employer side. From the governor's perspective, he says that's not fair. The cities and towns negotiate the employees, they negotiate the benefits, the wages, et cetera. They should have skin in the game, is his phrase. The cities and towns yesterday were out there saying, if you're going to do this to us, which you shouldn't do anyway, you got to raise the sales tax to ease the burden. There is zero appetite to do that particular measure. And that was far and away the biggest shift of money.
Anything else in there, Danielle?
The hospital tax doesn't seem to be having a lot of legs. That was the governor's proposal to let cities and towns tax hospital real estate, only the real estate, not the MRI machines and the other stuff. But, you know, I'm not seeing or hearing a lot of support for that one either.
And the thing that I offhandedly mentioned, a plan to transition group homes from being run by the DDS, the Department of Developmental Services, to private nonprofit providers, seems to have been shelved as well, Colin. I mean, I don't know. We're not down there every day, but what comes out of this? Yeah, we'll have a couple competing budgets, but as you say, a $1.7 or whatever it is billion-dollar hole is pretty hard to fill. You have the Hartford Current writing a big editorial saying, well, we can't raise any more taxes. We're driving people out of the state. Not a whole lot of solutions in that editorial. What are the solutions? I don't know what to do.
Work on that, Daniela. Yeah.
Blame the Current.
Right.
If I had solutions, my name would be Gandalf, not Colin. We also didn't mention that Governor Malloy's plan to kind of reorient the educational cost-sharing plan and maybe target cities and underserved communities a little bit more seems to be dead, too. I think, I don't know, you guys would know, but it's just like everything that you don't – every rock you don't have to turn over right now, you know, is probably, you know.
And I know the interesting thing is with Malloy is and this is kind of what's fascinating about this. A lot of people on both sides of the aisle have said we're happy he's talking about a lot of these things, saying we're happy he's talking about it. But then they go, yeah, but that's a hot potato, and I really don't want to put my hands on that.
Well, then back to your question. Yeah. I mean, look, part of the problem here, and this will be, I suppose, addressed more eloquently and knowledgeably by Keith tomorrow, but you know, a lot of the really big problems are problems that really would require a huge structural change. Like, I don't know. I mean, for example, tier one pensions, you know, I mean, you've maybe got to find a way. The things that are driving the $1.7 billion problem, it's not like government waste or anything like that at this point. It's structural problems that involve indebtedness, you know, that involve obligations that have to be met in one way or another. And so stuff like that, you know, I mean, you know, I mean, the tier one, you really, these are people who are retired for the most part now. There's not too much you can do to them except find a way to pay for it that you don't have right now.
And that last question that I had then, Daniela, whether or not Colin says, you know, if Ella Grasso was here, she'd you know, go in and rip everyone a new one and they get them to the table. How much of any of this has to do with Governor Malloy announcing, you know, he's not running again? Does Governor Malloy have enough skin in the game to be able to get these sides together to fix some of these structural problems? Max said people are happy he's talking about some of these things. Maybe that's something he has loosened up to do, to talk about the taboo. But I don't know. What role should the governor play in all this?
Well, everybody, you know, again, as Max said, everybody was saying what a bold budget he put out. And it was bold. And it was, you know, you can criticize it. You can say it's bold in a bad way. But it did tackle some of these longstanding things like, you know, inequities in education funding. I mean, these were big, huge problems. And, you know, he started the conversation about it. You know, whether he can bring these warring factions to the table, who knows? I mean, you know, does anyone have that kind of clout anymore? You know, I don't know if it's a measure of the governor's personality or his announcement from a couple of weeks ago or just the fact that, you know, times are different right now. They, you know, these folks aren't really beholden to the governor. They're a separate branch of government. And, you know, why should they listen to him? He can call them in and scream at him all he wants. But, you know, at the end of the day, who cares? You know,
Daniela Altamare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Our own Colin McEnroe. When we come back, we'll clean up some other issues that are happening at the state capitol. Later on in the program, we'll talk about not just what's going to happen with the XL Center, but now there's another big, you know, budget item that's leaking, the Connecticut Convention Center. A lot more to talk about. And we're here live on CTN. We'll even talk about CTN later today on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Daniela Altamare from the Hartford Current, Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, and our own Colin McEnroe, who has his very own program here on the station. It's called The Colin McEnroe Show. What's on the show today, Colin?
We're actually, partly because I did pledge this morning and I'm doing this now, we're going to re-air a program, a terrific program from last year. It's a program about gangsters. It starts with Deirdre Bear and her amazing biography of Al Capone. You think you know about Al Capone, you don't. And then we found this former member of the Gambino family who, while in prison, converted to Orthodox Judaism. So I don't even know how to describe that guy. You just got to listen. He's amazing.
That is fascinating. So the Colin McEnroe Show this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Hope you can join us. A few other things to kind of pick up here. I've got a new Quinnipiac poll. Max Reese says 60% of voters are in favor of making marijuana use legal. 34% are opposed. You know, we keep coming back to these things where, you know, it's not going to solve all the problems. But I don't know. We put Keno on the books. Is anybody talking about actually legalizing and taxing marijuana at the Capitol right now?
What's interesting about the marijuana conversation is that it kind of shifted from a mainstream topic, if you will, like this is a bill we want to go through the full legislative process on. We'll have a House debate on it. It'll be a full-throated debate over the issue of recreational marijuana, to what kind of shifted, I guess, about 2 weeks ago to, well, if we need like $100 million, then maybe we'll just like sneak it into the bill that implements the budget. Maybe we'll just do it that way, because then it won't be as, because that's how Keno passed. So Keno is very different than recreational.
Yeah,
marijuana.
It's actually, you know, the federal government, by the way, loves that when you just sort of sneak that bill in without a whole bunch of vetting. There's already problems with that. I don't know. Is that a conversation people are having? It's a non-starter, Danielle?
I think it is. I think the speaker said, you know, they're not going to, if they do it, it's going to be on, you know, whether it's good public policy, criminal justice policy or other policy. It's not going to be whether it raises money. The governor has been clear. He has not, to be fair, he hasn't used the word veto, but he has been extremely clear and very consistent from the beginning that this is not something he strongly embraces.
Right. So that's why it's a dead duck, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a way to legalize recreational marijuana. But to do this, you've got to do it the opposite way that it's been unfolding here. First of all, you have to have some consensus about it. And then you have to really, really look at the policy substructure of it. There's sort of a lot of different things that play into it. You don't want to, I think Massachusetts was kind of fast with this. You know, you legalize it and then you figure out all the other stuff that goes along with it.
And they did it differently by referendum, which is right. Not something that we would do here.
And I think there's actually a political opportunity here for the state where if you know, so when Massachusetts has it in full, when it's fully active in Massachusetts, Connecticut could look in and say, oh, we can take revenue from Massachusetts. They can do kind of the inverse of the casino argument, say, well, they're going to take money from us. We can take money from them. But I agree with Colin, Danielle. I think the issue is dead. But also, you need to have – you really need a bipartisan consensus on this. This is a gigantic social issue.
A few things that we didn't get to talk about last week in the show. There are so many people who are saying that they're running for governor or jumping into some other political race. We didn't get to spend the time, maybe, Colin, talking about the burgeoning candidacy of Chris Matty, which he announced last week in a fairly lengthy straight-to-camera video that you took some time watching.
Yeah. First of all, if you hear any dings or bloops as we're having this conversation, that's all of us getting emails from Chris Matty, which we now get like once an hour or something. I mean like sort of mass emails. And he did this campaign video. It's a 3-minute straight-to-camera Chris Matty sitting on the couch in his living room talking to the camera. With a little bit of piano music in the background. And for some reason or other, some of us, our eyes were drawn to his bookcases where, like, the bottom bookcase is clear. I guess he's got 3 kids under the age of 6 or something. They clearly, like, just yanked all the books out, you know, and then somebody ran and kind of jammed them back in, but the spines are facing the wall and the pages are sticking out. And I'm thinking, you know, just in terms of stagecraft, kind of maybe something you just want to just tidy up the house a little bit before you make your 3-minute straight-to-camera campaign video. He also has this very strange, large, metallic-looking M sitting. It's like the size of your head sitting up in one of the bookcases. I need to know more about that.
What do you think of Chris Matty here, Colin?
Studied very carefully. I mean, let me just say this. Okay, I'm obviously joking a little bit about Chris Matty. He is going around and having a lot of one-on-one conversations with people and impressing them with, you know, some of the things he has to say and his... I mean, the two people who are kind of out of the gate a little bit early right now, Matty and Dan Drew, I think are kind of doing some interesting stuff right now. Maddie's doing it a little bit more retail. Drew's, you know, maybe giving a few more interviews. And so although I intend to ridicule both of them, you know, as long as possible.
Well, Danielle, you wrote about Chris Matty, one of his pledges this week.
Yeah, he says he's not going to take contributions from lobbyists. He invited the other candidates to join him. Thus far, I don't think any have, although I did get an email from Joe Visconti saying he doubts any lobbyists would want to give money to him, but he supports him in principle. So we haven't...
That's not really the same thing as a pledge,
Joe Visconti.
It will all be better because Joe's running.
I think Matty's candidacy is this could, in some ways, shake up the race. I think he can own the outsider lane, if you will, on the Democratic side. He's been outside of Democratic Party politics for a while. He prosecuted John Rowland. That's a heck of a talking point. But also, if you look at some of the inner baseball here, Ted Kennedy was at one point under State Elections Enforcement Commission investigation. Jonathan Harris was director of the State Democratic Party. They were under state investigation. Chris Matty comes in as the clean guy who can who can come as like an anti-corruption, clean Democrat candidate. And I think that there's something to be said for that.
We also didn't get a chance to talk last week about Matt Lesser making this a similar sort of video, Colin, kind of jumping into a race for I'm not quite sure what, maybe Secretary of the State. Don't we already have a Secretary of the State?
We do have a Secretary of the State. And I mean, Matt Lesser is obviously very interested in being Secretary of the State. And then there's sort of this basic tribalism rule if you're in any way connected to the party establishment, where you have to wait for the person who occupies the office to announce his or her intentions. Lesser got out over his skis on this one. I mean, Denise Merrill, who's the current Secretary of State, has not announced that she's not going to run. In fact, I have actually had a conversation with her about this, where it seemed to me that it was maybe even a little bit more likely that she would run than that she wouldn't. But she's made no particular decision. And, you know, Matt Lesser has been in conversation with people, including Denise Merrill, about the future and stuff like that. But I just got so excited. He kind of got Lesser fever, you know? I'm not sure whether anybody else has it, but he has it, and he couldn't help
himself.
I thought
that went away in the 1920s.
Yeah, yeah. No,
that's right.
There's
thank you,
now
science.
New drug-resistant strains.
And maybe even we just have a minute left. Susan Bicewicz?
Yep, she's running. She's running against Len Susio.
So she's going to run to be a state senator.
Yep, she's coming back,
or
she'll try to come back.
She'll try to come back. I mean, what do we see as the chances of one time Secretary of State Susan Bicewicz, and of course almost Attorney General Susan Bicewicz, faring in this type, sort of run?
That district is interesting. Who knows? You know, it's toggled back and forth. It's probably one of the few swing districts in the state, legislative districts. So
it's very Meriden-y, though.
Yeah,
you know, she's the little
Middletown
piece of
it.
It's like very. It's sort of like Halloween and Friday the 13th and stuff like that. They just keep coming back. I think they're gone.
The only thing I'm wondering on the statewide side is if and when we hear from George Jepson about a governor's run or running again for Attorney General.
I doubt it.
We haven't heard from him.
He seems like he has his dream job.
He's a happy
guy. Surprised.
I think he was talking about it. You just couldn't hear him.
That's right.
I
missed it.
We got to take a break. We're talking with Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Danielle Altomare from the Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe. Right now, I'm going to turn it over to some friends who are going to tell you why you should support WNPR, not just conversations like this, but the news on Morning Edition, the Colin McEnroe Show, Where We Live, everything that you hear throughout the day. It's here because of you, listeners just like you. So make a pledge. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with our own Colin McEnroe, with Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, and Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Current. I'll let you know that coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on my program Next, we'll feature a long-form interview with Scott Conroy, who's a longtime political reporter, whose brand new book is called Vote First or Die. It's a history of the New Hampshire primary and how it got to be the first ever in the nation primary and what the impact of that was in the 2016 election. So you can listen for that tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on Next. Lots still to talk about. We've been talking, Colin, about the Excel Center in Hartford and whether or not the state should put $250 million to, spruce it up a little bit. Last week, the news that the NCAA was bringing some of their men's basketball tournament there, so maybe that's a good thing. This week, news that the New York Islanders probably weren't going to come there anyway, but it was at least something that people were dreaming about, now aren't going to come to the Excel Center. And so now what do we do with the Excel Center? I mean, do we actually need to spend money on an arena in the city that probably isn't going to have any pro sports team anytime soon?
Right. And I guess the question is, do we need to spend that much money, too? I mean, it seems to me, first of all, let's sort of back up and say, I don't know how we got into the world that we're in right now, but these arenas or these kind of sort of civic centers, for want of a better word, you know, I mean, for some reason or other, it's kind of understood that they have this incredibly short lifespan. And so, like, they're like good for 20 or 25 years or something. And so this thing has had its life extended and extended a number of times, and it's had more money poured into it to kind of upgrade it or at least keep it from becoming a danger to human life. But now they're talking about $250 million. Even in the crazy, unrestrained world of sports-related public spending, $250 million is a lot of money. I mean, look, you know, think about it. It costs $91 million to build Rensselaer. That seemed like a lot of money to me, you know. And, the Yard Goats Stadium seemed like a lot of money to me. So $250 million, that's a lot of money. And it seems to me an awful lot of it when you look at how it's costed out. A lot of it is going into sort of luxury boxes and, you know, stuff like that. And I'm wondering if, absent an NHL team, you could have a functioning civic center. You could upgrade this thing at a considerably lower price so that, yeah, you could have it be still a kind of semi-vital core where there were concerts and, yeah, you got the NCAAs coming, stuff like that. You know, there's a. I wrote a column about this, and Joe Markley wrote a response to it. I actually sort of agree with Joe Markley, even though he claimed to be disagreeing with me. $250 million is too much to spend on it. But is there – they always only ever quote you one price, right? You know, it was like with the yard goats. You know, Pedro and Sean go in there, and they come out with one price. And they go, oh, I guess that's what we have to pay. You know, well, there's going to be another price here.
Well, and whenever you do this, no matter what the one price is, it's always about twice that much money once you get into it. From the Joe Markley letter to the editor, which is titled McEnroe Wrong on XL Center. You have to read this. It's quoting you. I don't know where we're going to get $250 million to renovate the XL Center, but I think we have to do this. And then Joe writes, has Colin McEnroe ever written a more terrifying sentence? Which I sort of love as a response. Have you ever written a more terrifying
I'm
sentence?
Sure. Didn't I'm you sure. call me elegant elsewhere in this? In the,
I'll
in the
look
letter.
Down further.
I didn't even see this letter, so it was in the notes for today. I didn't even know this letter had been written.
Yeah, this is...
Joe Markley.
I'll read through. He's a more elegant and entertaining writer, but Moody's knows the numbers. No matter how much we might want some glittering toy, we can't put more debt on a credit card.
He's not wrong about that. I mean, he's not. You know,
no, he's not.
And $250 million is a hell of a lot of money.
What was if you looked at the list of the sites that the NCAA picked for early round regionals for the men's tournament specifically, Hartford and Cincinnati kind of stuck out. So Cincinnati also does not have a pro indoor team. They have the Bengals and they have the Reds. They have an arena there that's just like the XL Center. It's aging and it's just in bad shape. The owners of the arena had some ridiculous agreement with the city, and they said, see, we have a deal for the NCAA tournament. You have to put in like $100 million to fix this thing. City of Cincinnati said, I don't think so. Absolutely not. But we're really excited about the tournament. With Hartford, I think it's a pride issue. I think that there's a lot of people, the governor, Mayor Bronin, a lot of people live in Hartford, a lot of people live in this area, who will say, I can't imagine Hartford without an arena like this, a first-class facility. And I think all that goes kind of back to the Hartford Whalers. Like, we were once a city, a state that had a professional sports team. And I think that a lot of people are coming to grips with the economics of publicly financed sports arenas aren't really that good. Look across the street at the Yard Goats Stadium. We'll get there eventually, but the fact is Hartford's going to be in debt for a long time over that. And with the XL Center, I think that it's very hard to split those two.
And when you talk about debt, what Joe Markley is, of course, talking about when he mentions Moody's in his column, Moody's Investor Service put out a dismal report on our situation. The state's payments for debt service, pension contributions, and retiree health costs are among the highest of the 50 states at about 30% of revenue in fiscal 2016. It all comes back to what's in the budget, Daniela. The fact is that whether it's for an XL center that we might need or might not, the idea of putting anything more on the state credit card seems almost impossible.
Yeah, I mean, it all comes back to the same problem. It all comes back to the budget, and it all comes back to, you know, we talk about decisions made many years ago that we're still paying for. Well, you know, will two generations from now, will people say, geez, you know, they wanted to upgrade this arena, now we're still paying for it. You know, I mean, it's the same cycle.
Of course, the old Civic Center, the XL Center, Colin, was built back in the 1970s. The roof collapsed once. It's maybe reached the end of its useful life. The Connecticut Convention Center, however, was built much more recently. We read in the Hartford Current, Ken Costland writing about leaks in the roof of this new convention center that could cost up to $5 million or probably a lot more to fix.
Right. And so, I mean, this is a new development, and I think we need to know more about it and why it's happening. I will say that, I mean, not to bring up an old name, but I mean, a lot of stuff that happened at Adrian's Landing was farmed out by the John Rowland crew to, you know, people who were in various ways tight with John Rowland and his crew. I don't know that that's the case this time. But yeah, you'd like to think that there wouldn't be this $5 million problem so soon. And should I read the explanation?
Oh, the explanation is great.
So this guy, Robert Saint, who's there's a quasi-public that runs the XL Center and the Convention Center and all this kind of
stuff. We love quasi-public.
Yeah, the CRDA. And so Robert Saint, who's Director of Construction Services, says, it's like that second-level deck in your house above the living room outside the master bedroom suite that is now leaking and destroying the ceiling in the living room below. You're not walking out on the waterproofing. You're walking out on some nice-looking AZEK or mahogany deck that you have to take apart to get at the waterproofing to fix the problem, and then you have have to rebuild the deck. See, that helped an average Joe like me understand, because I have that problem all the time. And I'm usually
Luffy, there's a problem on the deck, Luffy, darling.
Could you get up here? Have one of the servants come up with a mop right now. Like, how is that supposed to be helpful? I mean, if you
want a duvet.
Yeah, if you want the public to really get mad at you about public spending on stuff like this, keep making explanations like that one.
That sounds just right. I love that explanation. Today, and fairly often here in the Wheelhouse, we're joined by the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. It was set up as a kind of C-SPAN for the state to cover what's happening at the Capitol. They provide robotic camera coverage in a lot of the rooms there, but also lots of other stuff within that building and happening around the state, lectures, press conferences. They do their own election night coverage, which is anchored by our buddy Diane Smith. We read in Kevin Rennie's Daily Ructions blog this week that that's probably all about to change. He writes, the Connecticut General Assembly's Office of Legislative Management released a request for proposals for operation of CTN, the public service network that provides public affairs programming. The goal of the proposal is, quote, the CGA is seeking to reduce the scope and spending of the production of CT network, understanding that this reduction may require decreasing the amount and types of coverage. He goes on to write, with the storm clouds continuing to gather over Connecticut's government, it seems a curious time to reduce the public's ability to engage its growing interest in public affairs. A reduction in the number of pieces of snail mail legislators create and send would save plenty of money to fund the dissemination of useful information. And he writes that RFP vests an alarming amount of authority in the legislature to determine what events outside the legislature will be covered. Notwithstanding the fact that I think what this RFP says, Colin, is that in the scope of the new CTN, the fine camera folks wouldn't come here and tape things like the Wheelhouse. It feels as though what the legislature is trying to do is wrest a little bit of control away from the vendor, the Connecticut Public Affairs Network, that has long had this contract, and say, we really just want pictures of us standing in front of lecterns addressing our constituents, and that's all it's supposed to be.
Yeah. So what is this? Egypt? All right. Who's the Speaker of the House, Arasemowitz or Al-Sisi? Yeah, a little bit more seriously. You know, there is a sort of ugliness to all this. I think Kevin is right in what he writes, and I think you were nice enough to fly-spec the RFP this morning because I was way too lazy to do that. But, I mean, it's, you know, really in general, what CTN does is a big part of what we think about as sort of open and informed government.
Yep.
And ceding a certain amount of control to CTN and letting them make their own decisions is really important. What's in this RFP is a lot of stuff like, well, the General Assembly will tell you guys what to do and what's important and what's not. Well, that is a little off-putting.
Yeah, I mean, in part it says, here's how you would cover public hearings. The awarded respondent shall cover as many full public hearings as possible. If possible, at least one full public hearing of each of the legislative committees is to be covered, but not at the expense of covering higher priority proposed legislation. The CGA will provide guidance on the priority of programming as required. So what it sounds like, Max, is that the Connecticut General Assembly will say, this is what you should take pictures of, this is what you shouldn't take pictures of, and this is higher priority legislation to feed for free out into people's cable boxes.
If I'm a taxpayer, I'm always thinking to myself, I want the government telling me exactly what I should and shouldn't be watching. Right. I say to myself that every day. Connecticut residents, Connecticut taxpayers, you need to know that CTN is an incredible service. It really is. Most states don't have something like this.
That is right.
They really don't. And if you wanted to see, hey, what did my state rep in Norwich say? What did my state rep from Naugatuck say? You can go online and find it. And you can, oh, I heard they were talking to a committee. You can find that. And the word for this is chilling, is really what it is.
Now, to be fair, the legislature itself, Daniela, put this all together some years ago. It's not as though this came from nowhere. The legislature decided to fund the CTN network, and that's why we have it in the first place.
They like being on television.
But that's the point. They like being on television.
They already control. I mean, Kevin Rennie in his piece mentions, you know, the amount of mail they send, these mailers. They all have fully staffed, some with many people, PR departments. I mean, each caucus, each legislator has, you know, a PR person. So they've already got plenty of ways to get, you know, their message out and their point of view out.
Yeah, when you go up to the top floors of the state capitol, you see these gigantic boxes sometimes mm-hmm. full of, and this is the Frank, right? This is all
yep.
the stuff that we pay for. And I've tried to explain this on the air before, Daniela, but it's hard to explain. But basically, there's a segment of the state budget that pays for an incumbent politician yep. to send out these mailers to just say, hey, remember me, I'm doing a great job for you, vote for me again.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, campaign advertising is what it is.
So which would you rather have, that or my favorite CTN show, Real Housewives of the Program Review and Investigations Committee?
To Danielle's point, there are a lot of people whose job is message control in the Connecticut General Assembly. And this would be message control on steroids. If they were able to say, well, this public hearing really isn't important. This other bill is much more important. You only need to see this other one.
Just we CTN.
But and to a larger point, as we just run out of time, Colin, I will say this – it does feel like it's part of a larger conversation we've been having for quite some time about transparency in government, about what happens at the state capitol and what we're supposed to know and not know. Earlier, we made kind of a sideways joke about, you know, burying something in the state budget on the last day. And this always happens, right? Things happen behind a cover of darkness, and we don't get a chance to see a whole lot of them. CTN, at its best, provides an opportunity for us to see a lot of what is going on. It does give a lot of face time to the lawmakers, and that is probably something they like a lot. But any reduction in the ability of a CTN or something like it to have some independent editorial control, it does feel to me like it controls the message even more and gives people even less of the stuff that they need to see.
You know, this is stuff that you just have to fight for over and over again. And really what we've seen, I mean, Governor Malloy has been a good governor in certain ways, but he had a hostility from day one towards watchdog agencies, trying to group them under some more controlling entity.
Point well taken.
Yeah, point well taken. And, you know, this just happens all over the place. The Trump administration recently decided that the White House visitor logs should no longer be FOIable. I mean, you know, you have to fight for every inch of ground, because ultimately what happens is people get in power and they think, well, there's no real upside to me to be at the mercy of any watchdog agency or FOI type agency. And so, yeah, if they could have something that's a little bit more like state controlled television as opposed to CTN having kind of a freer hand, guess which one they're going to pick.
All right. Well, for now, we're on CTN. Thank you very much, CTN, for having your
cameras
here.
We're not just saying
today.
This because you're here.
No, we really do love you. I want to thank not only Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you very much, Colin.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks to Danielle Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Thank you, Danielle.
Thanks.
Thanks to Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Thank you so much, Max.
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank our technical producer, Kyone Wolf, and also Heather Brandon, our digital editor, the executive producer, Katie Talarski. Continue this conversation on our website, WNPR.org/thewheelhouse. Now, right now, listen to these very friendly people who are going to tell you why you should support everything you hear on WNPR, because we want to bring you free and independent news, and we want to be here for you in the future. So call us now.